Like Mario. Okay, should we get started? Bismillah walhamdulillah wa salatu wa salam ala rasulillah wa ala alihi wa sahbihi wa baraka salam. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. So, last week we talked about intentions, and this week we're going to get a little bit more in specifics and how we can structure some of like our Ramadan strategy consciously around habit formation and kind of goal setting in that regard as well. And so we want to build off of this idea of why we do the things that we do, so that we can get to a place where we're building intentionality into this and rendering kind of wakefulness and consciousness in these decisions and choices. And this is a big part of Ramadan prep and the whole point of what it is that we're engaging in when we're fasting. So I want to share like a couple of different reasons as to why we might do some of the things that we do that aren't necessarily being consciously performed, but nonetheless, they are things that we end up kind of going along with. So one of the things right off the bat is a herd mentality becomes something. And when we talk about these things, we don't want to talk about them in the prism of just something being good or bad only with absolutes. Because what you're going to find is that most things are just things. And they can have benefits, they can have detriments. Some of it can be utilized to create positivity, some of it could be utilized to create negativity. So even this thing of a herd mentality, if I told you somebody follows the herd in their making of decisions, one could probably assume, well, that's just a bad thing, right? Like, why would you want to do that? But it's not necessarily the case. In our tradition, there's some examples that some of this is a problem, right? So within Quranic experience, there is a set of revelations in the beginning of revelation that essentially now bring the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, to kind of preach Islam publicly, right? The initial phase of revelation, he's just talking to his close friends and family members, and now he starts to tell people out loud. So the Prophet, السلام, peace be upon him, he starts to preach Islam out loud to people publicly. And if you're not familiar, the Prophet is known as just a trustworthy individual. He's somebody who has good character. He's known as being the trustworthy one, Al-Amin. They only know him through his honesty and integrity. So in one of the narrations, he stands now on a cliff, essentially, a mountain, and he says to people who have gathered, he's brought them to him kind of in the midst of the day, and says, would you believe me if I told you there was an army waiting behind this mountain to attack you? And they say, yes, of course. They only know him to be the trustworthy individual, right? He just doesn't lie, which is remarkable. He's a very honest human being. And so he says to them, then know this, I'm the messenger of God. If you were to follow what it is that I say, there'll be good for you in this world and the next. If you don't, then that's for like God, for Allah to decide between you and him. And people are listening. They're now reflecting, right? The society has no sense of accountability because their theology isn't rooted in an afterlife. They believe it's just this world and nothing else. So if theologically you believe that there's nothing after this world, why would you care what you do in this world, right? Why wouldn't you just do whatever you feel like? Do you know? Because if it's just this and then there's nothing after this, then I might as well get mine. Like, why do I care about you getting yours? What's the advantage to me being kind and compassionate, etc., when it's just in terms of my worldly existence and there's nothing that comes after? In Islam, the whole idea with the theology in one God, but also an afterlife, is that what you do here is going to impact where you're at when you are in like eternal existence now, right? May Allah make us all people of his paradise, his heaven, his Jannah. So here, The prophet is telling them something that they've never heard before. They've not rooted in a society that has modes of governance like this, right? There's no mayor of Mecca the way there's a mayor of New York City. It's a tribalistic society that is governed through like tribal norms and customs. It's highly stratified, challenges around gender, race, class, they permeate the society. And so he's saying to them, not only should we all come together, but we should have this structure of authority that we listen to God, and there's a prophet of God, and I happen to be that prophet, right? There's a lot going on in this. People are hearing what he has to say. Communication is not just about the words you use. Statistically, 7% of impact comes from the words. 93% is from non-verbalized aspects of communication. Your body language, your tone, the marketing, the packaging of something. So they know this person to just be a man of integrity and honesty. They're going to listen to what he's saying. And as they're listening, they don't know what to do. Like, nobody's doing anything. Then there's a person who is known as Abu Lahab. As the prophet has people's attention, Abu Lahab is like an elite member of this Meccan society, this tribalistic society. He's an elder. He's known for his tribe, his lineage. So he says to the prophet, peace be upon him, when he puts forth this, his response is to him, Taban laka alihada jamatana, that may you be perished. This is why you gathered us together. Because it's the middle of the day. He wants to go back to his like merchanthood, making money. Why are you distracting me with this kind of stuff? And then he says this and he walks away. And everybody else follows him. This is what like herd mentality is, right? We do this constantly. You walk through New York City. In New York City, you can statistically eat at a different restaurant every day for your whole life and never eat at the same restaurant twice. That's just a thing in New York that's not anywhere else. There's sometimes when some of you walk down the street and you see two places that you're trying to decide from and you don't know like what it is that one serves or the other, but because there's a bunch of people eating at one and nobody eating at the other, you'll eat at the one that has a lot of people, even though it'll take you longer to get your food, right? People do this constantly. I went to the doctor and I was sitting there with, I think one of my kids, maybe I was alone, but I'm in like an urgent care. And this is during COVID, there's social distancing. And, you know, I sat down. And then after a while, somebody said something to me, so I stood up. So when I stood up, like the next person that walked in, they didn't sit down. They were just standing also in front of a chair. And then another person came in. And then I sat down and they sat down. And then some lady came and said something to me. And then in my head, I was like, let's see what happens. So I stood up and then the other two people stood up also. Right? And then the next person that came in also stood. But they were just doing what somebody else was doing. Do you get what I mean? This is one of the reasons why you do things. There's another instance in the prophetic biography that revolves around a treaty that takes place known as the Treaty of Hudaybiyah. You don't have to remember the names of things. Just understand the concept. So this is after people have left from Mecca, where they lived for years, and they go to Medina because they were deeply persecuted in Mecca. In Medina, they establish clout and power. They're coming now to perform a pilgrimage back to Mecca, and the people of Mecca, who are not Muslim, sit down and they negotiate this treaty of Hudaybiyah. Part of the terms of this agreement is that they go back to Medina without performing pilgrimage. These are people, many of whom left their entire lives, their belongings, their home where they were born. They're not only excited to perform a pilgrimage, they're excited to go back home. And the prophet says to them, like, you know, slaughter your animals, remove your ihram, we're going back. Nobody listens. People are pretty upset. Umar radiallahu an, he says to the Prophet, Alasna bil Muslimin wa alaysu bil Mushrikeen, that are we not Muslims and are they not Mushrikeen? Like, why are we making deals with these people? Right? They treated them like garbage. He says the same thing to Abu Bakr. Abu Bakr says, don't you think the Prophet knows what he's doing? Right? And so the Prophet goes now into his tent and he speaks to his wife, Salama, and says, like, nobody's listening to me. You know? And she says, you go and do it, and if they see you do it, they'll do it also. So he does what he instructed them to do, right? Remove the ihram, slaughter the animal, and then everybody starts to do it. Do you get what I mean? But there's a catalyst that comes in kind of going along with the crowd. Another reason as to why we do things results from like emotional triggers, right? And we want to be able to think about what catalyzes behaviors sometimes. There's an experiment that takes place with three dogs. The first dog is put into a box, right? And there's an electric current that is going through the box. He's in a place where he has to just push a button, pull a lever of some kind that enables him to now exit into a second box, or rather, he just has to jump over a wall. It's a two kind of sided box, right? There's a part where the current is and a part where there's no current. So he gets shocked and he is hit by the current. He looks for a way out. He jumps over the wall into the other part of the box where there's no current. The second dog gets wrapped up in a blanket and that's injected with current. This dog has to push like a button, pull a lever to get out of the blanket. He's then in the box now that has the same voltage, the same current. Because he learned that when there's this kind of pain, there's a way out. He jumps out similar to the first dog after he looks for the way out, and then he's safe. There's no pain. The third dog is wrapped up and injected with current, but it's given no way out. It's just forced to deal with this. Then it's put into the first part of the box where the current is. It has the same ability to jump over the wall the way the first two dogs did, but because it learned when it feels this kind of pain, there's no way out of it, it just lays at the base of the box, whimpering until somebody comes to help it. Does that make sense? So some of what we respond to is just learned helplessness. We get to a place where the emotionality of it creates these triggers that has us now respond in this way, right? I smell something and it creates memory of someone I used to know from a long time ago, right? There's places I frequent and it evokes memory that now brings up like positive or even like negative feelings. And you get to a place where the emotions start to rise, you lose control, but the behavior still is rooted in action that's coming from us without consciousness necessarily, but it still results in something. Do you know? How many times have you ever gotten into an argument and then later on you say, like, I'm sorry, I wasn't myself, like when I was saying this thing to you, right? How many times have people said this to you? I was just in a bad mood, like I shouldn't have said what I said. Or even a bunch of people who don't even apologize after, right? But you just fundamentally know that the emotions are rising. There's an instance between two companions of the Prophet, a man by the name of Abu Dharr from the Ghaffar tribe and Bilal ibn Rabah. And Bilal ibn Rabah is the first like muezzin of Islam. He was the one who made the call to prayer. And they're arguing back and forth, back and forth. Emotions are escalating. And then Abu Dharr calls Bilal the son of a black woman, but in a derogatory way. And what makes it that much more crazy is that Abu Dharr himself is black, but he's a black Arab. So he's calling Bilal like the son of an African, as if this is something that's a problem. But once he says this, they both become quiet because both of them hear what Abu Dharr said. And Abu Dharr is very apologetic. He's like telling Bilal radiallahu anh, you know, to do something back to him, to put his foot on his face, like these kinds of things. When the Prophet hears this, he gets angry. And there's certain things that are done that are haram, that when the Prophet sees them, he doesn't have anger, right? Someone struggling with alcohol, someone, you know, struggling with like fornication. I kissed someone I wasn't supposed to. I committed, you know, these kinds of things. But there's things when the Prophet sees them that are haram that happen, he gets definitively angry. Racism, oppression, abuse, there's no words minced, right? Anger is apparent on his face. So he says, in this like state of upsetness, all of us are the children of a black woman, referring to Hajar, the wife of Abraham, peace be upon them both. But for the context of what we're talking about here, the emotions escalate and bring you to a place where you now say something or do something that you are still the one doing it, but it's being informed by a different part of you. Does that make sense? This happens in another instance where a woman is grieving at a grave, and the Prophet sees her and goes to offer consolation. And when he goes to offer her some support, she gets upset and kind of in her upsetness says to him that you don't know what it is that I'm going through. And he just simply takes a step away. And then later another companion comes and says to her, do you know who you just got mad at? That was the messenger of God. And now she's gathered herself and she goes and speaks to the Prophet. And the Prophet says to her simply, true patience comes at the first sign of calamity, right? He doesn't say, how dare you yell at me? Like, what's wrong with you? I'm the Prophet. He also can recognize through emotional intelligence, this woman is grieving her husband. Do you know? It's a very real experience. The wisdom of this phrase is not just to the other, that when you're riled up, like your sabr, your patience comes when like calamity hits. There's also a mode of self-talk, right? Because your emotions can now transfer to me and I can rise with your like rising emotional scale. So here, the Prophet like engages in his own centeredness as well. He's not responding to her emotions. Like when you are in a place where emotional triggers remove consciousness and you then come at somebody, it's really easy for them to also lose consciousness. But if one of you is like emotionally heavy and the other person is still centered, it creates now a different mode of engagement. I can carry your pain as opposed to like being burdened by it. Do you get what I mean? Right? And you see, like in very remarkable ways, and even the most kind of difficult circumstances, that these were people who did this, right? There's Ali ibn Abi Talib, who is the cousin of the Prophet, peace be upon him, and they're lined up at a battle called the Battle of Khandaq. And the way battles took place back in the day weren't the way that we see, like, you know, kind of through the glorified systems of war and military industrial complexes and people making money off of death, right? Like, these people were in battle, and you've probably seen like movies that are like this. So in one instance, they're now lined up and they send forth like their best warriors. And there's a man by the name of Abdul Wud who comes from the opposition, who's like a giant of a man that they say has never been brought down to his like knees, let alone defeated in battle in one-on-one combat. And he is a friend of Ali's father, Abu Talib. So they have a relationship. And the people start to mock because no one's being sent forth from the Muslim army to fight him, right? And where is the man who claims to be a messenger of God? Where are those who claim if they fall in this battle, like they're from the martyrs who go to paradise, etc.? And Ali radiallahu anhu says to the Prophet alayhi salam, like, let me go. And the Prophet says, no, this is Abdul Wud, right? Like, you can't beat him. He comes back a second and a third time. And then the third time he sees something in Ali radiallahu anhu's face. And so he sends him forth, like takes his turban from his head, puts it on Ali radiallahu anhu's head. And then he goes forth. And Ali says to this man, Abdul Wud, that I have heard that if one proposes two options to you, you take one or the other. And Abdul Wud says, yes. And he says, then leave us alone and you'll be free from harm. Like, don't do any more kind of harm or damage to us and our people. And he says, I can't do this. And then he says, then be ready to fight me. And he says, O son of my brother, I have no desire to fight you. And Ali says, but I have a desire to fight you. And they start to go back and forth. This man is towering over Ali, and he's astonished that there's like dodging and kind of moving here and there where he's not struck. And then at one point, they say Ali radiallahu anh throws like his shield and stuff to the side, and he propels himself with his 2 feet forward, striking Abdul Wud in the chest and knocking him down on the ground. Abdul Wud is now kind of straddled by Ali radiallahu anh, and he has like a blade against Abdul Wud's neck, and he says, "Just leave us alone and you'll have your life." This is in a battle, right? Abdul Wud now has to decide, if I was to give in this moment, everyone would know that I lost. I would lose like my status as not being beaten. But if I don't give in, then I'll still have that honor and dignity in that way. And so his response is he like gathers all the spit in his mouth and he spits in Ali's face. And then he clenches, waiting for a fatal blow. And to his astonishment, Ali ibn Abi Talib radiallahu anh gets up and walks away. And Abdul Wud says, "What are you doing?" And he says, "If I was to do anything to you right now, it would be from my own ego and not for the sake of God." His capacity to keep in that state, like a sense of balance and conviction, that's like the idea. You get elevated in this emotional stress as a means to recognize, like, I am the one feeling my feelings, so I'm bigger than the feelings. Thoughts can be pervasive, but somebody's got to be thinking the thoughts, right? Who's doing that? And so here, we want to think about it in terms of habits, because habits are things that we do automatically and repeatedly, and we do it quite often without conscious awareness. Sometimes this can be useful, but quite often that's not necessarily the case. They can be positive habits, but also negative habits. You can have physical habits, you can have emotional habits. They usually come at the expense of long-term consequences because they're giving you short-term kind of complacency and good feelings. Do you know what I mean? Right? And why we want to talk about this is this is what like Ramadan's fasting, reading of Quran, etc., is meant to inculcate. If you can open up on your phones, the second chapter of the Quran, it's 183rd verse. So Quran, the second chapter, Surah Baqarah, is 183rd verse. You're going to hear this verse a lot in relation to Ramadan. You want to know where it is in the Quran and to learn it and memorize it, right? Does anybody have it in front of them? 2183. Surah Baqarah, chapter 2, verse 183. Yeah, what does it say?
"O believers, fasting is prescribed for you as it was for those before you, so perhaps you become mindful of Allah."
Yeah, right? And the word here is taqwa. "Ya ayyuhalladhina amanu, kutiba alaykumus siyamu kama kutiba alalladhina min qablikum, la'allakum tattaqun." That, "O you who believe, fasting was written for you as it was written for those who came before you, so that perhaps you might attain this thing of taqwa," mindfulness, consciousness rooted in a divine imperative, that you know why you're doing what you're doing. You're not habituated. You're not just running on instinct. It's not just automated. There's presence to this, right? We're going to talk about this in a little bit, but I want to read to you a couple of definitions around what this thing of taqwa is. So there's a man who comes in the generation after the companions. His name is Talak ibn Habib, rahimullah. He says, "If an ordeal appears amongst you, extinguish it with taqwa." And when asked what is taqwa, he said, "Taqwa is that you act in obedience to Allah and hope in His mercy upon a light from Him. And taqwa is leaving acts of disobedience to Allah out of fear of Him upon a light from Him." Hassan al-Basri was a well-known scholar of our tradition. He says, "The ones who have taqwa protect themselves from what Allah has prohibited and act upon what He has commanded. Taqwa remains with them until they forsake many halal things, fearing that they could be haram. Abdullah ibn Mas'ud radiallahu anhu, who is the companion of the Prophet, known for his connection to the Quran, was one of the first people to convert to Islam, who is also not from an elite background. He is a black companion, described as having braids and dark skin by his students. He was the first one to recite Quran publicly ever in Mecca, and he gets persecuted and beaten heavily as a result of this. He comments on this verse that says about taqwa, O you who believe, have taqwa of Allah as you should have of Him, and do not die except in a state of submission, right? Ya ayyuhalladhina amanu ittaqullaha haqqa tuqatih wa la tamutunna illa wa antum muslimun. He says it means that God is meant to be obeyed and not disobeyed, remembered at all times and not forgotten, and to be thanked, and we are not ungrateful to Him. And then Abu Huraira radiallahu anhu, who's a companion, was asked about taqwa, so he asked the questioner whether he had trodden a thorn-infested path. The man said that he did, and Abu Huraira asked him how he walked on it. And the man said, when I saw a thorn, I kept away from it because I might be pricked by it. And Abu Huraira said, that is exactly what taqwa means, to take actions to avoid like these things that cause you harm, right? You have awareness, you have consciousness. Like, you know what it is that's going on around you. You know why you're doing what you're doing. And this is the whole point of this thing of fasting. It's not like done in a vacuum. It's not meant to just like create hunger and thirst, right? But you recognize it's never been about empty stomachs. It's about full hearts, right? You're nourishing yourself now and parts of yourself that quite often get left behind because everything is just instinctive and automated. You know, think about habits that you have. Do you know what I mean? How many of you wake up and the first thing you do is look for your phone? Most of us can think that that's something that we do instinctively. It's not a good or a bad, but just think about it, right? And the consumer-driven society that you live in, like, look at how different all of you are in this room. Do you know what I mean? Like, just by the look of us, we're all very different from each other. Most of us in this room wake up and the first thing that we do is look at our phones. Do you get what I'm saying? The whole idea is to create now like mass-produced habit. You get to a place where you think the thoughts you think are your own thoughts, but in reality the thoughts that you think are being compelled to be the thoughts that someone else wants you to think. Do you get what I mean? You go into like frenzies based off of some of this stuff. Do you know? And so we have like a common denominator that is purposely created for us to be influenced in our behavior. What we want to be able to do is reclaim it, right? I don't want to be the guy that is sitting in the bathroom and I don't know how to be still for a minute, that I got to pull out a phone and start looking at it. Do you know what I mean? Why would you want to do that, right? Just think about it. It's gross, you know? If you inspect your phone for just like the elements of urine and fecal matter that are on your phone from looking at your phone while you sit on a toilet, right? But I use this as an example because all of you can relate to it. Do you know? Either you know someone or you yourself do this. That's how deeply entrenched an habit can be, that if I was to say to you, would you want to be touching something every day that has pee and poop on it and put it in your pocket and up against your face and all this kind of stuff? But that's what the habit does. It removes consciousness. There's no sense of like my mind or my heart being present in this. And last time when we talked about intention, one of the things we said is that Ibn Taymiyyah, rahimullah, he says that the place of intention is not on your tongue, but it's in your mind and in your heart. So we want to get to be in a place where consciousness is what really deeply impacts us. Do you get what I mean? What I'd like for you to do is just take a few minutes. Notebook out, like pull out a phone, right? Whether it's got pee and poop on it or not. Do you know? It's gross, right? Yeah, you know what I mean? You know? Make a list of what are like habits that you have. But don't think about it just in terms of negatives. Think about it also in terms of positives. The good and bad habits, the things that you used to do and you don't do anymore. Because we are essentially creatures of habits. And if we can influence our behavior to the construction of positive, like social habit transformations, these are good things. But I got to know what I'm starting with as like a foundation. You know, so physical, emotional, mental habits. Like, what are places I go that just throw me off? Who are people that I talk to that it just becomes like habituated? Do you know? And the knowing of the self becomes really important in the knowing of the divine, right? So, like, what is it that kind of gets me going in certain ways? Do you know what I mean? Like, and how do I start to build this? Well, first, I just want to have a working list as we kind of go through some of this stuff. But go ahead. And you're just writing to yourself, like individual reflection. You don't have to tell anybody, right? It's just between you and you. But you want to like visualize it so you can say like, yeah, like, you know, I have a habit of like picking my nose. Do you know what I mean? Right? I don't pick my nose. Yeah. But, you know, you said you do. Yeah. Is that how you said? Huh?
You said that you do.
Me?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, everybody does once in a while. Right? Okay. So here, this is like a list you want to keep working on, but there's three different things I want to talk about in relation to this. It's going to help us get to a place where growth is gradual, do you know? And to be able to take advantage of certain things, the interjection of like micro habits to break up habits, behaviors that we know we just are falling into again and again and again, and how it is that we can start to take advantage of like the brains and the hearts that God has endowed us with to reach certain goals and objectives. Do you know what I mean? What permeates a lot of our challenge is when there's an act that we want to kind of deal with. You know, I sleep through Fajr. I can't wake up for Suhoor, the meal before Fajr, before you start fasting, right? Like, so in the structure of the day, there's a recommendation that the Prophet says, even if you're to drink a sip of water, like for your suhoor before Fajr, you should do it. There's barakah in it. But I'm having challenges getting to a place where I can like get out of bed, you know, let alone to pray Fajr on time. Like, it's hard enough to do that than to get up to like have like a meal at this part of the morning. Do you know what I mean? I want to read more Quran, or I want to like leave behind certain things. A habit has like parts to it. You have the action in and of itself, the thing that you're doing. You know, I bite my nails, right? I watch too much TV. I shop a lot, these kinds of things. But prior to, you have the thing that catalyzes and triggers this. And you also have something that's being satisfied like through this, a reward, a craving. What most people focus on is just this, like the act. And that becomes hard to at times kind of engage. But if you can figure out what it is that's putting the act in play, or what it is that is being satisfied through the performance of the act, it's easier then to find different things to yield that satisfaction or to control what it is that triggers this. Do you get what I mean? Does that make sense? There's a person in our community who came to see me many years ago, and she was having challenges because the relationship didn't work out. And this was somebody that she had built like a physically intimate relationship with, do you know? And so she had experienced this. And when the relationship stopped, she was in a place where she had now started to engage in kind of physical acts of intimacy just with herself, right? For lack of better words. And she felt very disgusted by it. Do you know what I mean? And so as we're talking, she's like, what kind of Muslim woman am I? Like, who does this? Like, there's something wrong with me. And she's like, and I can't get myself to stop. So I said to her, like, well, let's think about it this way, right? One, there's nothing wrong with you. You know, you're a human being. Humans have needs, right? And you experienced this relationship with someone. But the challenge is you're assuming why you do what you do without really thinking about other reasons as to why. And so as we delved into it, like, this was a person who doesn't really have that many deep relationships to begin with. Family life is not the best. And when she felt like love and safe and secure was when she was with this boy. And now she was in a place where she was trying as best as she could to replicate the experience so that for a moment she could feel safe and secure again. Because her mind had now associated that with like a comfort, a security, a sense of just kind of belonging. Do you get what I mean? Why this is relevant to what we have written here is because we're prone to a negative cognitive bias. Right now, there's like millions of stimuli like being thrown at you. You could be focused on my voice. You could be looking at this. You could be looking at this. You could be looking out the window. You could hear the noises that are coming from there. You could be listening to the person next to you. You could be engaged in all kinds of different things that in this moment, your mind is being exposed consciously and unconsciously to like so much different information, and you're trying to be as focused as you possibly could. You think, like any human being, 12,000 to 70,000 thoughts in a day. Statistically, 4 out of 5 thoughts, 80% of thoughts, are negative thoughts. 96% of thoughts are repeat thoughts. So they're compounded, right? I'm stupid. I'm so stupid. I'm so stupid. What a stupid guy. He's so stupid. They're all stupid, right? And then maybe in the midst of it, it's like, oh, like the weather is nice today. And then you go back again and again and again. If 96% are repeat, they're automated, that means 4% of the thoughts that you think in a day are done consciously. That's crazy from a numbers standpoint, right? So think about this poor person who's sitting there now in the aftermath of what her mind is bringing her to. And what she's telling herself again and again is, you're the worst, you're the worst, you're the worst. Do you get what I mean? And what makes you you is not like just this inside of you. You have what I've said, and we'll repeat it again and again, because you want to experience Ramadan as a whole being, not just like as a physical body, or consequently just as the aftermath of hearing Quran or reciting it yourself, or like fasting if you can fast, or giving in charity if you have the money to, without presence, right? It removes something if there's not presence that's there. Do you know what I mean? So for us to disrupt this, she's got to be able to think a little bit bigger than the act and think about why she's performing the act to begin with. And that's where consciousness comes in. How many of you have ever fasted in your life before? Just by a show of hands. Great. And when you're in a place where, like, if you fasted in Ramadan, how many of you have felt weird eating food on the day of Eid right after Ramadan? Right? Anybody? Like, should I be eating right now? Right, like the sun is up, somebody bought me these donuts, you know what I mean? Right? That's consciousness. For a minute, you have mindfulness in your eating. Right? It's the idea to step away from simply seeing and perceiving. You're not just hearing, you're listening. Right? You're not just like actually eating, you're tasting something. Do you get what I mean? That's what consciousness is. That's what gets diluted by being in a place where the physicality of it is what you're focused on. And if you can harness that consciousness, it's going to be easier to do something like this, because you don't give in to these things that are beating you down from your nafs, from shaitan's whispers, that are meant to like keep you stuck and paralyzed. Do you get what I mean? So when we're talking about it and we're breaking it down in this scenario, she just gets sad. Right? Allah make it easy for her. Do you know what I mean? And then in her head, she's got all of this rhetoric, like read online, you can Google whatever you want to, you know, khutbah, you're going to hell, this is going to hell. What a, like, the, right? So she's now engaged in it, and she's, her self-talk becomes automated. You're ugly. You're disgusting. What kind of Muslim woman would do this? Do you know what I mean? And then the temporary like reward that she gets for remembering what it felt like to be with someone when she felt safe, it starts to like just diminish in its impact. So the complacency isn't even there, right? And this is why I said habits typically short-term like yields at the expense of long-term consequences. So every time she's giving herself a burst of feeling safe, she's also like layering herself with an avalanche of just self-deprecation. Do you get what I mean? Ramadan can break you out of that mold, right? Because that's its point. لَعَلَّكُمْ تَتَّقُونَ So that you can perhaps attain this consciousness rooted in the divine. God is with you no matter where you are. So you don't have to be alone. It's God that's like watching over you, that loves you. Do you get what I mean? So you start to think about some of these things in this way. And this could be anything. I use the example that I use so that it stays with you, right? The permission of people. Do you know what I mean? Right? Like it stays with you so you can think about it. And now we want to think out, how do we then resolve some of this? You know? That's why like when you see people doing haram sometimes, most people don't do haram because they're bad people. Most people do haram because there's an absence of community supports, right? They're like struggling because like nobody's really checking in on them. They're like making space for them or asking them to do certain things, right? If you know that to be something that should be done for others, that means it should be done for you as well. Do you get what I mean? You don't want to just have complacency. You want to have like a sense of contentment, right? So how do we start to resolve this, right? Say I put on 20 pounds between now and Ramadan, do you know? And I'm thinking about how it is that I suddenly weigh this much. And I start to think about my eating behaviors, right? Because that's where my mind is gonna normally go. I put on weight because I'm like eating stuff. So I found that in the middle of the day, I eat like 5 chocolate chip cookies every day consistently. The problem with assuming what most people would assume is that I could be wrong in thinking not that the cookies are the issue, but that I'm eating the cookies because of the cookies. Do you get what I mean? Does that make sense? I could be getting up in the middle of the day every day at 2 or 3 o'clock just because I need a break from a computer. And then consequently, I'm in a place where I just grab some cookies from the table that I end up near. I might be feeling like I need to have a conversation. So the person's office that the cookies are in, I feel great just talking to them. And so consequently, I'm eating the cookies. Maybe it has to do with food and I just cut out the food. And when I get hungry, it's like, okay, I need a snack at 2 or 3. But we could go through like 15, 20 reasons why I'm eating the cookies for nothing that has to do with eating the cookies themselves. Do you get what I mean? And so you start to focus on some of these things and reflect upon it, contemplate. Like, what is it that's actually coming up? Does that make sense? Right? And you can disrupt some of these things by first acknowledging that they're there. What are like the thought patterns that I have that are habituated? The things that I say to myself because I've heard other people say this to me again and again and again. What are like words that just come out of my mouth instinctively? Like when I'm talking to certain people, I'm not fully present in these things. The goal isn't necessarily to say like I will start to calculate every single day what was a conscious thought and an unconscious thought. That's ridiculous. Don't do that. You're gonna go crazy, right? We don't want to be crazy, right? But you're just aware that this is a thing. You know that that's something, right? The same way you know it's going to snow tomorrow. So what are you going to do with an awareness that it's going to snow tomorrow? Are you going to walk outside in a pair of shorts? No, like that doesn't make any sense. You know that the snow is there. You're going to act accordingly in relation to its presence. So all you got to know is that this is a thing, right? This is a lot of thoughts to think in a day. Do you know what I mean? Right? So you want to get to a place where you can understand the negative cognitive bias that exists. And how do I start to just say the thought is there, but I don't have to do anything in relation to it. And then later when I'm feeling replenished, I can say, okay, where did that come from? How do I address it? Do you get what I mean? And it can come with other habits as well, right? What is it that I'm trying to gain from this? When people walk into my office, I don't want to drink anymore, right? I don't want to watch pornography anymore. I don't want to backbite anymore. I don't want to gossip anymore. I want to stop smoking weed. I want to stop being so mean and angry all the time. I want to stop being this, right? They've named certain things through some of this, and they're not necessarily thinking about it in these ways. Does this make sense, right? Okay, so what you want to do is first have like a sense of observation. You know, what is just some of these things that are happening habitually with regularity? What's getting in the way? And then you get to a place where there's a sense of reinforcement that gets rooted now in like rewards as well as punishments that are not like crazy terrible. Do you know what I mean? But still are understanding and recognizing behaviors in certain ways. So last time we were here, I talked about a woman who was struggling with alcohol in our community. And when she had gone sober for 6 months, I took her out for dinner, right? We didn't have to tell everybody we went out to why we were taking her out for dinner, but it was more to celebrate the overcoming of something she struggled with, do you know? So you can celebrate certain things that you have difficulty around. And you want to see, like, some days will be easy, some days won't be, but what are the things that are catalyzing it? I'm observing not just the performance of the act, But who am I around when I do some of this stuff? Who am I around when I do other things? What's the environment? How much did I sleep, like, on the nights that I was more prone to, like, yelling at someone or believing the worst about myself? Versus how much rest was I getting on the days that, like, that wasn't, like, a problem or an issue? Do you get what I mean? And there's a mechanism of kind of a sense of how do I reinforce through positivity, as well as, like, set for myself some mechanism of accountability that says, if this happens, then I'm not going to, like, do this thing anymore. Does that make sense? Okay. I know I've been talking a lot. Before we go into a couple of other things on this, I'd love for you to just turn to the persons next to you. What are you taking away so far? What's coming up for you in this conversation? And then we'll come back and discuss a little bit more. But go ahead. Okay, so what are some of the things that are coming up for people? What are we taking away so far? What are we talking about? Yeah.
We were talking about, like, how we, as humans, we have this, like, focused vision when we just, like, look to the act and start to judge ourselves and others, that this is good and this is bad, which is not like that. That actually we need to see any habit that we don't like as a manifestation of something deeper, and we need to, like, when we do quality improvement project for something, we need to do, like, the root analysis, or cause analysis, and we need to do, know what is causing this, why I'm doing this, why I'm so weak in doing this thing, and then, adapt, like, a model on how to fix it, and, like, try, and even if it didn't work, you go back and you try something new with your inner faith in God's mercy, and that at least you're trying. Struggling, you're trying. Maybe you're gonna. This will be. You need more time to just, like, try different things and know what actually works for you. And what actually works for you would be something that will reverse your triggers, or, like, inhibit your cravings, which is different for between different people. So just to have this in your mind and to or not, that your journey is very individual, despite like people helping you, but it's you who need to go through it.
Yeah, great. Other thoughts? What comes up? What do we discuss? Do you see a connection to Ramadan here? Can you see that connection? Or is anybody like, this is makes no sense? You can tell me, it's okay. I'm tough. Right, you're inculcating consciousness. You experience it, and you want to be aware of your ability to be aware of things. Do you know? And how you start to build some of this in now at a time when you're regulating, because you're bringing presence in. The other thing that happens here is that the shayateen are chained in our tradition. So waswas like becomes limited in a certain way. It's just you taking on your nafs, for a lack of like better words, right? So I am now confronted a little bit more with my ability to say, like, hey, what are some of the things that I can work on as I'm regulating and reclaiming self-control? How do I apply that now to this coming Ramadan? That isn't like a complete overhaul, right? You are like a good, beautiful person. You don't have to think about yourself in some other way. Like iftar in our tradition is not just like a feast of food, you know? Because like the fundamental feast at the end of the night is really like a feast of Quran. That's what you're nourishing yourself off of when you're standing in Tarawih, right? This is called like the banquet in and of itself, like through our texts. They're talking about like the recitations that your heart is now being nourished on, you know, and it's inculcating consciousness, because this is what it says in Surah Baqarah, ذَلْكَ الْكِتَابُ لَا رَيْبَ فِيهِ هُدَى لِلْمُتَّقِينَ. Like, this is a book, in it there's no doubt, a guidance for the people of taqwa. Do you know? The whole month is about, like, let me go back to what actually makes me human. Let me go back to, like, what it was I was intended to be. Do you get what I mean? So we want to think about it in a couple of other ways, right? One, like this aspect of mercy is something that's really important to understand. And Ramadan is a month of mercy. So there's a companion by the name of Abu Sa'id al-Khudri radiallahu anh. He reports a hadith that I'll read in its entirety. It's really long. That speaks about a man who killed the 99 people. Many of you are probably familiar with this hadith. Some not so much. But think about in terms of habits and mercy, right? He killed 99 people. That's not like a one-off thing. This is something he's doing with regularity. There's a man from among a nation before you who killed 99 people and then made an inquiry about the most learned person on the earth. He was directed to a monk. He came to him and told him that he had killed 99 people and asked him if there was any chance for his repentance and to be accepted. He replied in the negative. This man said, no, you cannot be forgiven. So the man killed him also, completing 100, right? I did 99 times. I can't get forgiven for it. Why should I stop? Let me just kill another person. Astaghfirullah. He then asked about the most learned man in the earth. He was directed to a scholar. He told him that he had killed 100 people and asked him if there was any chance for his repentance to be accepted. He replied in the affirmative and asked, who stands between you and repentance? Go to such and such land. There you will find people devoted to prayer and worship of Allah. Join them in worship and do not come back to your land because it is an evil place. So he went away, and hardly had he covered half the distance when death overtook him. There was a dispute between the angels of mercy and the angels of torment. The angels of mercy pleaded, this man has come with a repenting heart to Allah. And the angels of punishment argued, he never did a virtuous deed in his life. Then there appeared another angel in the form of a human being, and the contending angels agreed to make him arbiter between them. He said, measure the distance between the two lands. He will be considered belonging to the land to which he is nearer. They measured and found him closer to the land of piety where he intended to go, and so the angels of mercy collected his soul. In another version, it said he was found to be nearer to the locality of the pious by a cubit and was thus included amongst them. And then another version says, Allah commanded the land which he wanted to leave to move away and commanded the other land, his destination, to draw nearer. And then he said, now measure the distance between them. And it was found that he was nearer to his goal by a handspan and was thus forgiven, meaning he was closer to the land that should take him to chastisement but Allah made it appear that he was closer to the land where he would gain his repentance, right? Meaning, like, you just gotta try. Allah's looking for a reason to accept, not push away, right? This is like a rule he sets for himself in Hadith Qudsi, that he's like mandated his mercy over his wrath. Do you know? So that aspect of mercy is there. It's also narrated that he drew closer simply by a slight movement of his chest. Do you know what I mean? So when you're in this place, you want to think, what are my actual habits? And this has to be through a prism of honest self-criticism, not in a place where you are self-deprecating. Who cares what people think about you? What you think about you is important. This is what self-esteem is. Self-esteem is how you perceive yourself primarily. Self-esteem is how you perceive yourself. And then second, how you treat yourself through that perception. Does that make sense? And if you got this much negativity running through you, you're going to beat yourself up sometimes, right? So that productive reflection has to be something that's done in a moment when you're ready to admit, like, you know what? I actually do, like, yell at my kids all the time. I actually am in a place where I gossip a lot. I do have this habit. But first step is recognizing with honest self-criticism. The second you get to a place where you build like an accountability mechanism, you are in a place where you seek help if you need help, right? Why is it a problem if you can't wake up for Fajr on your own that you ask somebody to help you wake up for Fajr? What are you gonna prove to anybody if you do it by yourself and then you just don't do it? Who cares? Like, what aspect of your ego are you trying to adorn that you gotta be the one to do it? Do you know what I mean? I sit down with people constantly and they're like, I gotta make sure, like, this person understands this, this person understands. So I'll say to them, do you have to be the one that gets your mom and dad to understand why they should let you marry this person? Or, like, is the goal just to have somebody get them to understand it? Right? They've never thought about it like that before. The ego interjects itself sometimes subtly and sometimes overtly, right? I don't have to be the one that always tells people things. Sometimes it's just about strategizing what's going to be the best course of action. Don't tell the world your business. Do you know what I mean? But if you got a buddy who can be helpful, this woman who I told you about last week who struggled with alcoholism, right? If you weren't here last week, she didn't want to drink anymore. And so she said, can we work on this? And then she was anxious because she was going to visit her family on Thanksgiving. And she said, everybody drinks. If I don't drink, they're going to think that it's strange. And so then when I saw her sometime later, I'd given her my cell phone. I said, give me a call if there's a problem. I didn't hear from her. When I saw her sometime, I said, how'd it go? And she said, it was amazing. They were all so drunk, they didn't know I wasn't drinking. And I said, oh, okay. Great. And then she like got into it. Some days were heavy, some days were light, but then she got to that place where went 6 months without drinking this stuff. Do you know? Then I said, let's go out to eat. I didn't do anything for her, but she had to overcome within herself the idea that reaching out for help somehow meant that there was inadequacy in something. Do you get what I mean? You have to also be someone that can help someone in their time of need. You don't know like what people are going through, right? So say salams to the people that you're praying with. Like actually talk and learn people's names. Do you know? And be in a place where you don't have to know what to do. That's not the point. But you can at least be in a place where if someone's there, you're the first aspect of like getting them the help and accountability that they need. It's not always just about like deep struggles, right? Like, do you exercise more if you have a friend with you? Then why don't you get a friend to go exercise with you, right? Are you gonna go to a halakha more if you know somebody that's there? Then don't wait. Call up somebody and say, let's go do this together, right? Why? Why would you just do it alone? Do you know what I mean? Don't do it alone. Get somebody to help you. And the third part to it Remember this hadith and thousands of hadith that are like this. Allah's mercy is real. So you just trying to overcome it is going to be helpful. Some of the things that we want to talk about in relation to this, it's not about like doing 50 things all at once, but find a couple that you stick with. Consistency is going to be important. The Prophet had Abdullah ibn Amr ibn al-As come and ask him for advice, right? Awsini ya Rasulullah. And the Prophet gives him advice. He says, Ya Abdullah, la takun mithl fulan, kana yakumu layl wa taraka qiyamu layl. That, oh Abdullah, don't be like so-and-so and such, kana yakumu layl. They used to habitually stand in the night, wa taraka qiyamu layl, and then they abandoned the standing of the night, right? Meaning the night prayer. Do you know? So make for yourself an indication. If you're going to read the Quran inside out during Ramadan, why would you stop engaging it after Ramadan? Right? And you have to speak kindly to yourself. And sometimes the kindest thing you can say is when it actually makes sense to tell yourself, this is dumb. It's nonsensical. The things that you tell yourself that are dumb are not the things you should tell yourself that you're dumb for. But some of these things, they just lack like wisdom and insight. If you have the capacity to fast, and you can fast like the first day daylight savings times hit, and it's going to be a long day of fasting, like why would you not fast in the rest of the day when it's shorter? What's like fundamentally keeping you from doing this? Do you know? So istimrar, consistency. This is a big part to developing sound faith and spiritual excellence. It's not like the quantifiable aspect with the qualifying aspect that comes from doing it repetitively. It's a spiritual exercise. Do you know? In the same way with habits, right? You want to build a habit, just read a verse every day. Read a couple every week. Go at a pace that makes sense so you're building strength around it. You want to be in a place where you have self-awareness. So Abu Salama ibn Abdurrahman reported from Abdullah ibn Amr that the Prophet ﷺ said, I have been informed that you stay up in prayer during the night and fast during the day. Abdullah answered, yes, O Messenger of Allah. And the Prophet said, fast and do not fast. Pray and sleep. For your body, your wife, your guests have a right upon you. It is sufficient for you to fast 3 days a month. Abdullah said, I wanted to be stricter on myself. And I said, O Messenger of Allah, I have the strength to do more. And the Prophet said, then fast 3 days a week. Abdullah said, I have the strength to do more. And the Prophet said, fast the fast of the Prophet David and do not do more than that. Abdullah inquired, what was the fast of David? And the Prophet replied, he would fast one day and then not fast the next. So he goes now from 3 days a month to 3 days a week to half of the month. It's not a quantified aspect, it's a qualified aspect. In other narrations, this companion is recorded saying, I wish I had taken the advice of the Prophet and done one of the lesser fasts. Meaning he stayed consistent with it throughout his life. Istimrar is part of the goal. You want to be consistent. But why is he trying to do more rather than doing what makes sense for him? You're not in competition with anybody else. Do you know what I mean? You got to work at a pace that makes sense for you, but you have to have self-awareness that makes sense, right? You can sit on the toilet and look at your phone for an extra 10 minutes, then you got some time in the day to open up the Mus'haf and read one verse of the Quran. Do you know what I mean? You can be real with yourself, right? It is something that you can see as you engage in the course of your routine. But that self-awareness is important. What I'd like you to do now is just take out your notebooks, and we're going to start to build structure over the course of these weeks to how we engage the day, right? Because a big part of understanding time management is that time management is essentially management of the self. So take a few minutes. What is your day like? Map out your day from what you do as soon as you wake up. You're going to work, you're going to school, till the time you go to sleep. Right? And you want to start to build this type of relationship with your actual schedule and routine to be able to see where there's things that are just habituated. Because when I sit down with people who are in a place where they don't know how to make decisions, their world is heavy, they have zero outlets or mechanisms of self-care, I say to them before they're like, just tell me what to do. I'm like, I can't tell you what to do. It's not my right to make your decision. But I can help you get to a place where you can make decisions. Tell me what your day is like, your week is like. They've never thought about it. There's no presence in why they go to bed at the time that they do. Like, they don't realize how little food that they're actually eating, or when they eat, they're just eating like the fastest thing you can get because everything is just like hectic. I gotta get to class. I gotta do homework. I gotta be at work. Like, all is rooted in no sense of presence, and it's just like on autopilot. Do you know? So for us to bring certain things into our routines, you gotta know what your routine is. If it varies day to day because of the phase of life that you're in or the nature of your work, right? There's doctors who work 14 days and then don't work 14 days, and then they work 14 days, right? That's the schedule. You have like a sense of adaptation. In these days, I'm like this, and these days, I'm like this. Some people work Monday through Friday. Some people work on Saturdays and Sundays. Some people work a few days a week. Some people don't work any days. That sometimes is even harder, because when I'm sitting and I have nothing that structures my routine, the self-deprecating thoughts can be that much heavier, right? Everybody's got a job but me. I got nothing to do. I got no friends. There's no one to hang out with. Do you know? But if we know the routine, we can problem solve to be able to start thinking, when do the pervasive thoughts actually surface the most? When are they not present? When do the habits kick in the most? When are they not present? How come it's easier for me to pray like Fajr, but really hard to pray Isha on time, right? Why is it like that I can like do certain things on these days that I'm praying my sunnahs for Dhuhr and Asr and Maghrib versus like the days I miss it just feel very different? Do you get what I mean? So step one is you live your day every day. Do you know? What's going on in the course of your day? And if there's segmentation that the weekends are different than the weekdays, like we'll talk about this as we go through this over the next few weeks, but you want to have like a structure to this so you can understand how that time is being utilized. Does that make sense? Okay, so let's do that for 2 minutes and we'll come back and do something really quick and we'll wrap up. Just like, what's your day look like from when you wake up till you go to bed? How are you spending your time? Do you know? Like, and as detailed as you can is ideal. So I go to work is not the same as I wake up at 6 o'clock in the morning. I'm like, you know, eating breakfast. I'm doing these things. Or like, I wish I woke up at six, but I'm actually waking up late every day and like running to something and doing this and doing that. Do you know what I mean? Because it makes a difference, right? If you start your day with anxiety, you're already chasing after something versus like your day is started with calm and ease. Do you know? Okay, so you want to continue to do this over the course of the next week, we meet again, and start to then think, like, in terms of objectives, goals, habits, how much of that is spent on some of this stuff, and where can I build good ones and break down bad ones, do you know? How do I, like, start to change behaviors, right? I used to exercise 3 times a day when I was in high school. I was supposed to play sports in college. I got injured in my senior year of college, of high school, and then everything stopped. I went to NYU as an undergrad, where, like, just no, like, you know, especially back then, like, sports non-existent. Do you know what I mean? It's a D3 school. And then I started to, like, practice Islam more, like, consequently, which is great, alhamdulillah. Probably wouldn't, you know, Allah knows best, been, like, Muslim if I went down, like, an athletic route. But, and I started interacting with, like, Muslims more, and they didn't really exercise, do you know? So I would go to the gym, but it now became, like, different. And then when I, like, made some decisions around my studies and other things, and then started working here, I had no, like, self-care strategy and no work-life balance at all. I was getting sick all the time. My weight would fluctuate a lot. I was very lonely, had no deep relationships, let alone friendships. The irony of it, I was surrounded by more people than I'd ever been, but I felt more by myself than I'd ever been also. And it was really hard. But when people used to ask me about my exercising, I would always tell them what I used to do. And it wasn't a deflection, but that was just the nature of the conversation. So someone would be like, do you go to the gym? And I would tell them how much I could bench press or how much fast I could run a 40 in when I was, like, at this age in my life. And people were shocked because they were like, who, you know, that's, like, not normal. And it was just kind of appeasing the conversation until I got to a place where I was, like, broken inside and out. You know, my wellness was non-existent. So then I got to a place where I had to figure out, like, how to start getting myself to exercise, do you know? And I looked at my routine. I was like, well, when can I do this thing? So I started working out more so in the evenings and different times. Then I got married and, you know, I was at the tail end of, like, poor self-care. And my wife, this amazing person, had no hesitation in telling me where I wasn't taking care of myself, right? A month into our wedding, or after our wedding, she's like, you don't have any friends. And I was like, what are you talking about? Do you know what I mean? We had 2,000 people at our wedding ceremony. It was like an open invite. They had 6 jamaz for Asr at the 96th Street Masjid that day because of how many people came to our wedding. Like, the masjid filled over 6 times, mashallah. Right, so 2,000 is conservative estimate. Now she's telling me in my face, you don't have any friends. I'm like, what are you talking about? Look at how many people. She's like, you don't have any friends. She's like, you have no deep relationships. You don't invest time in it. And she said, physical wellness, non-existent, you know? So I was like, great, right? So I tried to, like, figure out some of it, got back into it. And then COVID hit. COVID was a big mess. A lot of trauma we were carrying. If you were here, you saw, like, our community's response. Micro cash grants to people in need, food insecurity programs. We're seen as a major house of worship in New York, and a lot of people turn to us. I was, like, dealing with a lot, sitting sedentary now in our home. My neck got messed up. I herniated 2 discs. I, like, was a lot of random physical health issues, and there was no place to exercise. And now, like, I had to go to physical therapy, get back into it again. So it's like a third time I'm trying to figure out how to rebuild a relationship with this thing of physical wellness, right? And it was tough. Like, I tried to get, like, on a machine to, like, run, and I couldn't run for longer than 6 minutes, you know? I would go to my physical therapist for my neck injury, and in COVID, I got physical therapy just because of connections in our community, because you could only go to certain places if you were in the most, like, need, right? So it was me in this physical therapist's office, and all the other participants were, like, 85-year-old white ladies, you know, who had, like, severe ailments and needed this. And they could lift more weight than I could because I had injured my neck. This whole part of my neck was swollen up to here, and I had to reteach myself how to use my left hand, right? So I was holding, like, weights that were 2-pound weights that I don't know why they make them like neon pink so they stick out in your hands. And I'm holding these things. This is like old lady is next to me and she like grabs like a 5 pound weight. She's definitely looking at me like I'm a miserable person. My physical therapist said to me, do you want to go to like a private room? Do you know? Right? She's like, old ladies are being mean as anything. I was like, no, like I'm not embarrassed. Just because I'm at a place doesn't mean this is where I will be. And I'm not in competition with that old woman. You know what I mean? Right? But I had to like recognize certain things. So now I have children and I'm married. It's very different than when I'm single. There has to be adaptability in my routine, right? So I shifted from the evenings to like the mornings to work out. And then my intention became important. I had to recognize that like exercising for vanity didn't work for me. But when I rooted it in wellness, it was now something that I wouldn't leave behind. I went to Michigan with my son this weekend. I think I said it in this class, if not the one before it. And on Saturday, we woke up. I told him, like, I'll take you wherever you want, but you're going to go to the gym with me on Saturday morning. And we went to the gym and we exercised because I know I'm not the same when I do it as when I don't do it, right? And it's about just like the mental clarity and wellness that it takes. To get to that place, I had to recognize my habits. I'd wake up for Fajr, self-care is non-existent. My prayer was like non-existent. You know, I was doing it, but what was the impact? But I just jumped back into bed, do you know? So I had to figure out, how do I break this cycle, right? So I like would like take a shower instead of making wudu for Fajr, do you know? I'd go to sleep in my gym clothes, do you know what I mean? Like all kinds of things to create micro habits to now influence the habit that was getting me back in to bed. Do you get what I'm saying? I'm still not like a fit human being, definitely not the way that I was before, right? But I know like where my healthiness becomes a priority and then my routine reflects it, right? But I first have to gauge in my structure, what's going on? What are things that are not adaptable? And what are things that are, and how do I start to bring in something? I don't have to work out 3 times a day. That doesn't make any sense. But I can do things consistently on a daily basis that add to the healthiness of it. So for you, what you want to think out, if you're overcoming a bad habit, one, you want to become, like a step number one, conscious of what you're doing and why you're doing it. Recognizing like these like points. What am I doing and why am I doing it? 2, you want to become a long-term thinker rather than a short-term doer. So invest in the long-term benefits of something rather than quick fixes. Do you get what I'm saying? Does that make sense? You can come in. Yeah. You want to become a long-term thinker rather than a short-term doer. You don't want complacency, you want contentment, right? I have to think, I'm 41 years old, I love my kids, I love my wife, I love the community I serve. I don't want to be a miserable, like 60, 70 year old person, do you know what I mean? That has short term, like thoughts that say, well, this doesn't hurt at this time, or this like seemingly still works. I said to my wife the other day when we were sitting on the couch, I'm ready for the reality that my left hand is just not going to work properly for the rest of my life. When I get older, it's going to probably be tougher because the neck injury I sustained, do you know? But like, alhamdulillah, right? Like, what can I do? Do you know what I mean? But my 70-year-old self, if they have to deal with that, if I live that long, I don't want that 70-year-old self to also hate who I am now because I wasn't thinking about getting to that place in my life, right? So be a long-term thinker rather than a short-term, like, doer, right? It might be easier to just sit on your butt and not go to the gym after Fajr Khalid, but like think about the long-term benefits, do you know, that you're gonna gain. Enlist the help and support of friends, family, and community. None of us is able to kick bad habits and start the formation of good habits just through like ourselves alone. You don't have to do that. You can try, it's gonna take a lot of energy. Do you know what I mean? But when you're willing to like overcome the ego and recognize like you're good, right? You don't have to like be embarrassed. Don't like you know, tell the world your business, right? But lean to people who you trust and you have confidence that they'll carry it with you and they'll create those accountability mechanisms. And then if you have a more entrenched habit that's an addiction, you want to seek help for that. So if you're struggling with substance abuse, pornography, spending issues, you want to recognize it and then ask for help and support. We have people in our community who help with this, right? Some of the best emails I get are every like year on certain days, members of our community write me an email and they'll say, I'm 15 years sober today. Do you know? And then they'll say, tell all the people in this community, I couldn't have gotten here without them. You don't even have to know who it is, but just know when you show up at Jummah and they see you smiling and giving salams, when you're like in spaces, every one of you, it makes people happier to be around people. How much would it suck if you showed up at Jummah and it was me and you only? That's it, right? You're like, what am I doing here? It's not even enough people to pray Jummah, right? You know? Versus you walk into a room and we're eating together, we're praying together. It makes a difference. There's a chance that you're using things to try to fill a void, these bad habits. And it's easier, but easier doesn't mean better. So when you have support, it can help you to figure out what's going on and then realign it. That's like fighting a bad habit, making a good habit, and then we'll end with this. You want to set a specific goal as step number one, right? So say I'm trying to get better sleep. If you don't have specificity, you're going to get to a place where it's ambiguous. So there's a difference between saying I want to sleep more versus saying I want to have 7 hours of sleep a night, right? To plan ahead, that's where that routine is. How do I shift what I need to in order to achieve this thing? 7 hours of sleep a night. Three, again, like make yourself accountable. Get someone to help you and you make your intention explicit by verbalizing it. Then four, you implement the behavior. It's not enough just to talk about it. I want to fast on Mondays and Thursdays. Then do it. Like get yourself to do it. Step number five, stay disciplined. That if you slip, you just get up and try again because you're changing habits. It's not going to be like from tonight, you're going to suddenly sleep 7 hours if you're more accustomed to sleeping like 5 hours or four, but you have to get like adapted and accustomed to the behavior. Six, seek support from others. And then seven, you want to reward yourself with something healthy when you're successful. Do you get what I mean? When I came back from Umrah with our group in January, I'd gone to Egypt and then come back and then to Toronto and came back and then went to South Africa and came back and then went for Umrah and came back. And on these trips, I'm out of my routine. You know, my exercise is off. My eating habits are off. I came back like heavier than I've ever been in my life. So I told my wife, like, when I lose like a good chunk of this weight, I'm going to reward myself with something, right? And she said, isn't that like kind of defeating the point that you're going to lose this and then you're going to eat like this mess of stuff? I was like, no, I'm going to do it to just reward myself. But I have it as like an expectation, as an outcome that like I'm not denying myself, but I'm rewarding myself like something I'm looking forward to, right? And you can say, does these things work? Yeah, 100% these things work. When people say to me, how do you get so much done in your day and your week? I went out to dinner with a bunch of people the other night, undergrad kids, 20 of them, some grad students, most of whom I haven't had a chance to spend meaningful time with, a lot of first years because of a lot of the things that we've been dealing with in the last months, right? Allah make things easy for all those who are going through difficulty. And this kid said to me, how do you remember all of our names? Do you know? And then they tested me on the train and I said all of their names. They're like, whoa, like, how do you know this, right? There's barakah when you have structure. There's barakah when you're around good people, right? I spend my day, every day of the week with people like you. Do you know? How can I not have like some blessing in my day? Do you get what I mean? I come down here, I pray with you all, like four of my five prayers. And at Fajr time, I'm praying with my wife and my kids, right? So I can tell you when you ask like, how is it possible doing this and doing that and whatever else? Because these are things that it's not enough to just know them. You have to act on what you know and give yourself like a pace to do it. So if I'm working on getting my wellness in check and overcoming certain habits, then like I'm probably not working on something else simultaneously, you know, at the same time. Does that make sense? Right? So you got to actually like do it, do you know? Okay, we're going to wrap up here. And next Monday, this building is going to be closed. So we're going to meet at the NYU Gramercy Green building where my family and I live. We're going to have like the Hadith class before and iftar before. It's President's Day, so if you have the day off, like come and break fast with us. Like just be with us in community. Probably be a little bit more of like a social type engagement, as well as like doing some of this stuff around Ramadan prep in the class before. And bring people with you who typically might not be able to come because, you know, they don't have Mondays off, but now they will. I'm in the same vein, right? Like, you don't know if you bring someone with you, it'll be like a thing that changes stuff up for them, where they're like, man, like I got to come to stuff like this because I just want to be around people after work. Also, I'll make those steps. Do you get what I mean? Does that make sense? Two other quick things. The building tomorrow is going to be closed because there's a storm coming. So inshallah, Allah keep us safe and everyone safe. And make special dua, right? Like, I don't know what everyone in this room does during the course of their day, but there's a lot of people who, whether it's blizzarding or not, they still have to leave their homes, do you know? And many of those people provide services that we then benefit from, whether we're conscious of it or not. So just think, like, tonight, how do you prep for tomorrow? And if you order some food delivered to your home, make sure you're like tipping the guy a little bit more, because he's not making a lot of money. It's a lot of undocumented people who are getting paid in cash, like lower than what minimum wage is, and they're going to plow through the snow to bring you that sandwich. Don't write a bad review or be upset that it's cold. It's going to be snowing. That's why it's cold. Do you know what I mean? Right? Like, use these opportunities to overcome habituated acts of the ego, right? And think with compassion. Do you get what I mean? But prep for it, and then use some of these nights to make dua for like our migrant sisters and brothers who are going to be sleeping on the street during this thing, like people who have no shelter, people who are going to have to wake up at 2 a.m. to come still like clean these buildings because they're considered essential like workers. Do you know? Like, if it's not us who are thinking about them, who else is going to be thinking about them? Do you know what I mean? And Allah protects them and gives them good in this world and in the next for everything they're doing. But the building will be closed tomorrow. And then on Saturday, we're doing a film screening and a dinner through our Latino Muslim community group. You don't have to be Latino or Muslim to come, but the documentary is gonna look at the development and establishment of a Muslim community in Chiapas, Mexico. It's a really powerful like piece. The director is going to have a talk back with us. There'll be dinner and dessert. And it'd be a good way for us to also just support this segment of our community. Most Muslim communities are very homogenous and ethnocentric, right? If you look at yourselves right now, like, there's not a majority of any one like racial cultural group in this room right now. As much as your mind might think, like where I'm seated, you're all very different from each other. That's not how a lot of Muslim spaces function. The advantage of our space is then you can learn, like through our Black Muslim lecture series about Black Muslim experience, understand the immense like contributions that Black Islam has had to Islam on a whole, the rich scholarship that comes, right? And you know how most communities like intra are challenged on racial issues. It's our benefit to learn about like narratives, experiences, etc. There's that many less spaces that cater to Latino Muslim experience, right? There's not like established masajid that are just like Latino run and kind of functioning, do you know? So you think about like brown people who then get assumed to just be like brown other than what their actual brown identity is. It can be very kind of isolating, do you know? So we want to show up in like good numbers, learn about the experiences because we have something to learn. Right? How many of you know about the Muslim experience in Chiapas, Mexico, right? And why would you not want to know about that? Do you know what I mean? It's not just because I'm not Mexican, you know, so why is it relevant to me? You're Muslim. You should know about it. So think, like, for Saturday, 5 o'clock, it's going to be in the fourth floor auditorium of the building next door. It connects from our floor as well. And there'll be dinner as well. So show up and, like, let people know also. There should be no reason why that room isn't packed. Do you know what I mean? Right? Other than we're just not thinking about it the right way. Does that make sense? Okay. So we'll send out emails with, like, addresses for next Monday. But we'll see everybody next week then, inshallah. All right. Assalamu alaikum.